quorum.
We take our seats and get started in just a minute here. I'll start the committee in a second, but if Kent Sulam and Joe Manske can get ready, and that would be helpful. If you're here. Will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Representative Hornstein, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, and I would move that we approve them, Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein, I was unaware that we don't have minutes in the packet. So
a trick question.
So obviously you didn't review the minutes thoroughly.
I took a mental note of those.
Okay.
A mental note. Well, and when we do have minutes, I would move that we approve.
I apologize for that.
We do have a floor these days.
Yeah. Well, I just want to put together a little timetable for today. First, what we'll do is I will move the Kiffmeyer bill. Then we will take the remaining testimony. And then I will allow Representative Kiffmeyer time to wrap up and play her short video that she wanted to play on Thursday. And then after that time, we'll move on to amendments and take a vote on that bill. And at that time, we'll move on to the Benson bill. I apologize for the order being incorrect on the agenda, but I think with the fact that we need to get the video out and it's a little bit bigger bill to deal with, I think we'll take the Kiffmeyer bill first. So with that, I will, as you recall, lay the bill over on Thursday. So with that, I will take House File 210 up. I will move House File 210 be recommended to pass and be referred to State Government Finance. Now, if we could start testimony with Kent Sulam and then Joe Manske, if you are here.
Mr. Chair.
And then after that, we'll have Catherine Doerr. Representative Scalzi?
Mr. Chair, would you let us know if we're able to ask questions of the testifiers, or do we have to hold them off? Like the last hearing we had, we didn't have questions.
Sure. Again, Representative Scalzi, if you have a burning question that you have of the witnesses, by all means, ask a question. Just keep in mind we're trying to get through two bills today, so if you can be judicious in asking questions. We will have, I think, Secretary of State Ritchie will be here later, so I do expect that there'll be some questions for him in particular. So perhaps we could just kind of play it by ear, and then certainly there'll be questions for the author of the bill and on the amendments after that. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulam, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to address concerns with House Files 89 and 210. I also want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for meeting with us. I know I spent probably a combined 2 hours with her over the last week. I know some other election officials met with her yesterday, trying to better understand the concerns that we have with her bill in particular. I want to make it very clear that I am not here today to talk to the pros and cons of the policy of showing photo ID. You've heard a lot of people already testify to that, and I'm sure you'll hear more or receive more letters on that. What I'm here to focus on is the process of, does this bill work? Do the bills work administratively? As a legal advisor to nearly 1,800 township clerks, it's important that we understand how the bill plays out and how we would administer it at the local level. And at that point, we do have a number of concerns. I'm going to touch on just a couple of them, and then Mr. Manske will highlight a lot more as somebody who's had many years of direct experience running elections. I do want to point out, having said that, that one thing to remember is that election judges and the head election officials at the local level are the first line of defense, if you will. So if you've got a bunch of irate voters, we're the ones that are going to be taking the heat from those voters if they're having problems with the new law. So I do just want to point that out. One of the items I want to highlight is that in order to make voter ID work, there is a requirement to have provisional ballots. That's covered under both bills. And there are some just inconsistencies in both bills with current law. For example, House File 89 gives a voter 5 days to prove their identity and residency. House File 210 provides that they have 7 days to prove up their true identity and residency following the end of the election. However, at the state level, at a state election, canvassing of the election occurs within 3 days. At my township level, most of that canvassing occurs the night of the election and by law must occur within 2 days of the election, which means that unless we figure out how to blend the two provisions, we would have to canvass and certify the results of the elections before the voters have had the opportunity to prove up their ID and residency. So just some inconsistencies there. It's not clear in the bill when a voter must go to the county official to prove their residency and ID and when they come to the local official. If they're coming to the local official for a local race, say the March election, it's going to be a situation where we're going to have office hours that we normally don't have, and that's going to be a great expense. There also is no issue to provide what happens to the school bond referendum, who's the election official for elections at that point for proving of the provisional ballots. I know we're running low on time, although I had talked with Rory about having a combined block for us. Hopefully I can wrap this up very quickly and give the rest of the time to Mr. Mansky. But to use the poll book is certainly a very intriguing concept. There are some very positive things that could come from it if and when the technology plays out to do what it promises to do. However, at the current time, we're very concerned about the costs and timing requirements for this bill. It does provide that the initial acquisition of the computers would be paid for by a state appropriation, but there are a number of accessory items that would be required that would not be covered by the appropriation. Supplemental equipment would not be covered. You know, if we want to have backup computers, backup systems, that is not provided for in the bill. And, of course, the long-term replacement costs are not provided for, which means ultimately this does become an unfunded mandate. There's also very serious concerns about the ability in the rural areas to provide for the electronic communications and dedicated lines. I know that the bill does provide some provisions for that, but from emails I've been receiving from city officials who have been communicating with the vendor, the technology does not work the way the bill is structured to set up. I think Mr. Mansky will address some of that in more details. The last 2 points I'll leave you with is that another section of 210 would subject all rulemaking to legislative review and ratification. The amendment that was adopted last week does make it proactive rather than retroactive, so that's an improvement. But we have concerns of if the legislature does not ratify, if we can't get agreement between the bodies and the governor and the rules are never ratified, how do we administer the elections? How do we train and teach people how to implement this bill? So that is a concern. Lastly, I want to talk, this bill also addresses absentee ballots and provides that absentee ballot boards would have to meet daily. Currently at the local level, for our local races, we only meet if we receive a ballot. If we must meet daily for the period of absentee balloting, that'll be a substantial increase in cost as you're paying for the clerk's time and the judge's time when there are no ballots coming in. So with that, I'll stand for any questions and reserve the rest of the time for Mr. Mansky.
Thank you, Mr. Mansky. Please state your name and who you're with and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Mansky. I am currently the Ramsey County Elections Manager, and I'm actually here today to speak for the city and county election officials around the state. I guess for those who don't know me, I actually was with the Secretary of State for 15 years, and one of the people I worked for was Representative Kiffmeyer when she was Secretary of State. I just wanted to give you just some basic concepts from our standpoint on this whole subject, and then make a few points, and then maybe it would be more productive for you to just ask me questions. That might be the better way to kind of get where we're going here. But let me just leave you with a couple of thoughts. Number one, that simple is better than complex. That what we're looking for here is a process that is easy for the voters to comply with, and easy for the election judges to administer. The more complex we make it for both the voters and the election judges, the more problems, the more mistakes we're going to have. Second, it's probably not a surprise to anybody in this room, but next year is a presidential election year. Next year is also the year when we are going to be doing most likely legislative redistricting or dealing with the aftermath of that. And we would suggest to you that that is not the year that we want to make any major changes to our election laws. So from that standpoint, it's probably worthwhile for you to consider deferring any really major activities until 2013. Third, on the whole poll book issue, it is something that we have had a long-standing interest in, and I can tell you from the standpoint of the Secretary of State's office, at least when I was there, that we actually looked at the use of driver's licenses and similar technology back in 1990. So this has been a long-standing interest of ours. Again, it's a big deal. It's something that our preference would be that you would defer until 2013. And our suggestion would be on that issue and on some of these related issues that you might want to put together a task force or authorize the Secretary of State to put together a task force to study this issue and then come back to you with recommendations in 2013.
Thank you very much. Do you have a question you'd like to ask, Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mansky, you just mentioned something about a study. I've heard that suggested before. Someone like OET or someone else here at the state who would study the feasibility of the technology? Is that what you're talking about?
Well,
Mr. Mansky.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I think there are several aspects to this. Not only do you want to have people who have an election background, and that would be some of the people in this room, and frankly, I would include some of the people at the table here. I think it's highly appropriate for some of the members of the legislature to serve on a task force like this. But since this is a technology-driven activity, I think it would also be appropriate to have some contribution from the people who know about the computer systems and the telecommunication network.
Thank you. Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, I may also echo that. I think a good model for that would be the HAVA study group that was in place and then Secretary of State Kiffmeyer was deeply involved with as we looked at the evolving technologies for HAVA equipment and the challenges that pose. There was a wide array of stakeholders involved with that group looking at what equipment is out there, what's going to work, how do we pay for it, how do we distribute the equipment. It took a couple of years to get it all in place, but it worked very well in the end.
Representative Simon.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And for either of you, but I suspect Mr. Mansky will want to answer this. Can I ask you how this would work practically? Let's say someone challenges someone, and maybe this is no different under current law, but let's say someone challenges John Doe at the polling place and says that he's a felon and shouldn't vote. And he vehemently denies that, but nonetheless he's given a provisional ballot and he has to come back within a specified number of days to the county or to some government office and prove otherwise. How does John Doe prove that he's John K. Doe and not John J. Doe, the felon? How does that happen? How does he prove a negative if he's challenged on that basis?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I mean, you ask a very good question. At the polling place currently, the person who has a felony challenge is then given the opportunity under oath to respond to questions from the election judges. And if the voters' responses to the judges' questions fail to show that the person is not eligible, which is to say that the person is eligible to vote, they let the voter sign the roster and cast a ballot. Under the proposals before you, that becomes a far more difficult situation that you then have to come back to our office, and again, you're faced with this situation of determining what the eligibility status is. And let me answer a question that you did not ask, and the whole business about provisional voting. Our view is that provisional voting is just a total non-starter, that if we have questions about someone's identity or eligibility, that we should deal with that either before Election Day or at the polling place. The idea that there is a kind of a second electoral process occurring after Election Day, we think is just a really bad idea.
Okay, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I just have a question because I visited my local DVS License Bureau, and I asked, you know, what it would cost. It was $18, and I says, how long would it take to get this photo ID? And I was told it was 4 weeks. And I'm not sure if the bill is going to change, so it would be the local license bureaus or the 10 testing sites in the state, or if it would be the auditor, which would be, as I understand it, your office. How would we make sure that people could fit within the 5 days or the 7 days to meet the requirements after casting a provisional ballot to be counted?
Mr. Mansky.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, again, you ask a good question, and one of the problems here that perhaps the committee has not considered is that if we have this 5 day period after the election for people to continue essentially the provisional voting process, we would be unable to finish that by the time that the state canvassing board has canvassed the results of the state primary. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure exactly what we would do with the results from the provisional voting. There are two other problems with that, however. Number one, that at least in one of the bills, the only place that you could go to get one of these voter IDs is an operation that was run by DVS. In our county, there are only two places that meet that definition, mm-hmm. Town Square and Arden Hills, in a county of 500,000 people. So that strikes us as a problem. And the other thing that I think it's useful to remember is that even though there is a provision in the bill for free voter ID, the documents that you need to get one of these IDs are not free. For example, if you don't have a driver's license and need to come up with a birth certificate, under our state law, those cost $26. And as a matter of fact, $10 of that was imposed by you folks last year to balance the budget. That's all state general fund revenue. If you were like me, who was born out of state, and I did this recently so I could test this process out, my birth certificate, which came last week, cost me $27.45 from my home state. So having the free ID sounds good, but the problem is the documents that you need to get the free ID are, in fact, cost someone. There is no waiver to get these documents.
Mr. Sulam, I do want to remind members that we have a number of additional witnesses, as well as the Secretary of State, as well as at least a dozen amendments. So to the extent that we can hold back, I would be appreciated if you have a quick response. And that goes for the witnesses, too. If you could be concise in your answers, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, I just also wanted to point out from a legal perspective, putting my attorney hat on, that there are data practices issues that would have to be resolved. I have an email that says that the Department of Public Safety would not allow access for verification purposes in most of the scenarios outlined by this bill. So that's an issue that would have to be taken up perhaps by the Data Practices Committee, but there are some serious conflicts with that statute.
Ms. Scalzi.
And just as a follow-up, and unfortunately, Ms. Chair, we've been through two hearings. We have not been able to ask a question. I have serious questions, and I feel like I'm being told not to ask, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. Thank you for that. The other question I have is that, as I understand these bills, there is no requirement for a photo ID for an absentee ballot. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. So what I'm thinking is that, is there a penalty for asking for an absentee ballot with a little white lie? For instance, if you live in a senior housing and it's a little difficult to get to where you need to get this photo ID, why wouldn't you just say, and in fact they do say this because I've talked to senior housing, they do say it's difficult to stand in line, so I'm going to vote by absentee ballot. So I would like to know, is there anybody that checks on these seniors who tell these little white lies because it's difficult? And is there Is there a penalty for this little white lie? And then how do we then, in the absentee ballot process, how do we protect that ballot so that there's not a lot of illegal voting going on? Because if it were me, that's what I would do. So I'm just asking that.
Mr. Mansky?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, and I'm going to be right on point with this so I can answer this quickly. Answer to your first question is yes, there is no provision here to have a photo ID requirement for absentee voters. Second, it is a felony to lie to us on an absentee ballot application. So I don't encourage that, but if you feel compelled to, we would be happy to let the county attorney know that. But third, and more to the point, is that, you know, when you apply for an absentee ballot a week or a day or 10 days before election day, and you tell us you're going to be out of town because you have a reasonable belief that you're going to be out of town, how do we know that you're not? And as you're filling out the application, how do you know exactly what's going to happen on election day? It's you know, no one is investigating to determine whether your grandma was actually in the polling place on election day, and I don't advocate that we ever travel down that road.
Thank you very much for testimony. We'll move on. If there's a Catherine Doerr here, and then David Maida, if there's a David Maida here. Is there David in the room? Okay. Then we'll have Walter Hudson would be next then. Is there Walter here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with.
Thank you very much. My name is Catherine Doerr. I am from Northeast Minneapolis. Excuse the voice, I have a little bit of asthma. I am grateful that the committee has allowed us to talk today to this issue and these bills. I am a member of the League of Women Voters of Minneapolis and also Citizens for Election Integrity and other groups. However, today I'm speaking on my own behalf. You have heard other people with many facts, figures, and studies, and I wish now to share my perspective. I have registered voters at the state fair and many community events and conventions, as well as on election day as an election judge. My father was a career United States Air Force enlisted. I wear the vote in honor of a veteran button often in honor of his memory. He spent his life defending our democracy in World War II, Korea, and the Cold War. These bills dishonor his service. I have been an election judge for three times, 2008, 2009, and 2010 in Minneapolis. I have found in my experience at the polling place that Minnesota citizens take very seriously their vote. Many ask questions when filling out the voter registration form, wanting to avoid mistakes or omissions. People are eager to vote on election day and see it as their civic duty. And this is what I believe. Every person has a dignity, worth, and deserves our honor. Voting is a right. Let me repeat that. Voting is a right and not a privilege. I will defend to the last ounce of energy I have the right to vote of every citizen. And to those who support photo ID as the best idea since sliced bread, I have these questions because I need to know what the playing field is, and these terms have not been defined in the debate. Number one, define your terms. What exactly do you mean by voter fraud and voting irregularities? Please give examples. These words you banty about so freely, and I need to know what you mean. Second, we have provided evidence to the contrary about these charges. Where is your data and your studies in support of the claims you make? Third, where in the United States or Minnesota constitutions does it say that some can enjoy the right to vote and others not? In conclusion, my opinion this action is taxation without representation. If citizens have to pay taxes, either sales tax, property tax, or income tax, they are going to be blocked from voting for their proper representatives. I urge you all to vote no on these bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Was Walter Hudson here? Okay. We will have Gerald Kalert and Samoan Hall. Are either of those folks here? And then if Linda Hoon can get ready to go next, that would be great. Good morning and welcome to the committee. If you could just please state your name and who you represent for the tape.
My name is Simone Hall, and I am just a regular citizen. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Simone Hall. My seven-year-old son and I reside in at People Serving People, a shelter for families in crisis and unstable. My situation is stable now, but I'm surrounded by people in crisis. I believe this photo ID bill is very unfair for them and thousands of Minnesotans who do not have stable housing. On election day, I vouched for several moms I know who are staying in emergency shelter a few floors just below me. One mom voted for the first time in years, and it made her feel extremely happy to finally feel a part of society. People lose their housing for so many reasons that are out of their control. Renters get foreclosed on, jobs are lost, and domestic violence and divorce, just to name a few. But when people are homeless and they still show up to vote on election day, they're saying, I'm working to make my life better, and I refuse to give up. It's not easy for a person living in poverty or in a crisis to get a state-issued ID. There's the cost of the ID, plus they also have to have two other forms of ID, like a birth certificate, which was stated costs $26 in Minnesota, and a Social Security card. When moms are fleeing abusive partners, they are thinking about their children, not about packing documents or other forms of identification. Hundreds of Minnesotans who are eligible to vote simply are too poor to afford stable housing. Low-wage workers living from paycheck to paycheck are one unexpected cost away from becoming homeless. The parents who are staying at People Serving People are constantly searching for stable housing. I've moved over 20 times in my life, moving without the cost of private transportation, money for a storage unit, and in a crisis, it is difficult to keep track of all necessary documentation. Survival instincts kick in, and only safety and the basic needs are our priorities. It is a blessing in Minnesota. It is a blessing that Minnesota allows eligible adults to vote, regardless of their housing circumstances. Minnesotans are losing their housing in this economy. They're losing their possessions and their dignity. Minnesotans in poverty should not lose the right to vote. They can't. If they can't afford a stable address, that's the only way that they can get a voting chance. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is Linda Hoon here? And then we will take Christopher Bell. And then after, it looks like Linda's not here, Christopher is, and then we will take Susan Miles, and then that wraps up our testimony other than Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State.
I might be a little helpful, I don't want to Oh, I apologize. We'll get someone to help you up there. Thank you for being here, and welcome to the committee. If you could please just state your name and if you represent an organization.
Sure. Got to find the microphone.
Oh.
Oh, there it is.
One of the pages assist.
Oh. Where is it? There. Try to move over. Oh. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Christopher Bell, and I am here representing the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for the time that she has spent with me and other people in the disability community so that we could explain to her our concerns and try to address them in her various amendments. My principal point does not relate to photo ID, but does relate to restrictions upon who may assist a person with a disability or a person who does not read or write in voting. And it's my contention that the section, I believe it's 16, subdivision 1 of her bill in Article 2, violates the Federal Voting Rights Act. The Federal Voting Rights Act in Section 208 makes it very clear that any person who is blind or has a disability or who cannot read or write is entitled to assistance by a person, quote, of the voter's choice, close quote. In the substitute all amendment, however, there are a variety of restrictions placed on who may provide assistance. It is a little confusing because there is a provision in that section that says that a person may obtain the assistance of anyone the person chooses, but then there are more specific limitations. Of particular concern is the limitation that unless a person is deafblind or, I believe, unable to be understood, they cannot get the assistance of a paid caregiver. And that, of course, is a restriction on the person's discretion to select who they want to assist them. Persons who are physically unable to mark a ballot are required to seek the assistance of election judges. Again, not up to their own particular choice. And although I understand that this section provides, again, that a voter does have a choice, the more specific language setting out restrictions is likely to be interpreted to be the controlling standard. And also, this is very confusing to election officials. It would be very difficult to understand who gets to assist and who doesn't, because there are these sort of conflicting general provisions you get to choose, and then under these circumstances, you don't get to choose. Finally, Madam Chair, members of the committee, as a taxpayer, I don't want to see the state waste money, and I know that none of you do either. If we pass an election law that is in violation of the Federal Voting Rights Act, we are setting the groundwork for complaints and possible litigation. I do not have a crystal ball, and I'm not saying those things will occur. On the other hand, if they do occur, it will cost the state money. And why should we lay the groundwork for litigation, costly litigation, when it's completely unnecessary and when compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act is very easy to do? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bell. You're very good because you actually kept that to exactly 3 minutes.
Wide luck.
Funny too. I was mistaken. There are actually two more people: Susan Miles and Vic Harvath, who had been on the list since Thursday. And then that will wrap up our public testimony, and then we'll move on to the Honorable Mark Ritchie. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the tape.
Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, my name is Susan Miles, and I am president of the Minnesota District Judges Association and has served as a district judge chambered in Stillwater for 14 years. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to appear today. I come to state the position of the Minnesota District Judges Association on the repealer of MnStat Section 204B36 Subdivision 5, which is contained in Section 31 of the bill under consideration today, that is House File 210. MDJA's dues-paying voting members include virtually all active district court judges in the state of Minnesota, plus some of our Court of Appeals judges and Supreme Court justices. Adoption of this proposed amendment would create chaos out of judicial elections in Minnesota. Since 1949, district and appellate judges who are running for re-election appear on the ballot with the words or the initials INC next to their names. Judicial elections are intentionally nonpartisan, but the INC designation provides voters with a valuable piece of information regarding differences between the candidates. Voters can decide based on whether they think the incumbent has been doing a good job or not. For years, special interest groups have been trying to strip the judicial ballot of the incumbency designation in order to turn these into partisan political contests and increase the likelihood that their candidates would unseat experienced judges. They correctly predict that without the incumbency designation, judicial elections will turn into political free-for-alls. Not only would party endorsements become commonplace, but so would unseemly campaign promises and mudslinging advertisements. Nothing I could imagine would lead to a quicker demise of the public trust and confidence in Minnesota's judicial branch than a politicization of judicial elections. Beyond the direct impact on judicial elections, this amendment would do a grave injustice to the quality of the entire judicial branch. Lawyers who seek appointment to the bench do so knowing the risks of having to run for re-election. That risk analysis includes the fact that to date, elections as a whole have been reasonably orderly and not terribly expensive. Changing that risk analysis by removing incumbency from the ballot will deter qualified candidates from seeking appointment. Most qualified candidates would conclude that the benefits of serving the public in a respected position are far outweighed by the detractions of waging ugly, bruising campaigns and raising significant amounts of money. The quality of the bench in Minnesota is practically second to none, as nationwide surveys have consistently shown. This amendment would lead to the inevitable erosion of that quality, and the public as a whole will pay the price. Whatever problem this repealer is intended to fix has not been identified. In other words, there is nothing to be gained by passing this provision, and there is a great deal to be lost. Thank you for hearing my remarks, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. The final public testifier, Mr. Vic Harvath. Is he here?
Mr. Chair, he's coming up, I do have a constituent who asked on Friday to testify. Is it possible she could follow with short testimony?
Yeah, I'll have Roy talk
Roberta
to her.
Roberta Blomster.
Yep, that'd be fine.
If she can come up and wait.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and if you're representing an organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vic Harvath. I'm not part of any organization. I attended here last Thursday and just saw some things that I thought I might comment on. My background, I'm 70 years old, worked at Honeywell for 10 years, built a lot of machinery, automated type of machinery, technical support, troubleshooting, and today work as a plumber, troubleshooting, semi-retired, but still called on all the time. So my background is trying to find trouble and solve the problem. Some of the things I've heard, I've got 11 grandkids, all the way from four of them in college to somebody that's 4 years old. I've talked to the ones in college. They say photo ID, that's a big laugh. Everybody has that. It's no big problem to get it. One of the kids says, tell the kids to, using the word kids, to get a life. They've got photo ID all over the place. A lot of them are walking into bars, and none of my grandkids go in those places, but they said they walk into bars. They're showing their ID all the time. They're buying cigarettes and everything else. So, and as far as seniors, I have a mother 90 years old in Augustana home, photo ID, and everybody I visited around there has a picture ID. So it's all over the place. I'm part of a seniors group at our church, 35 to 40, and I've asked them in the last week, we've talked about other times, every single one, 100% think photo ID would be a great thing. I've been a head election judge in North Minneapolis on Plymouth Avenue. Many people walk in and have their license already out. As working in the polling place, it would be a big help to the judges registering if somebody comes in and hands you a card with a name on it. You're trying to find names of people that you can't even understand their language. You can't understand how they spell the name, how they pronounce it, or anything. So that would be a big help in the friendliness that we would have working the election process towards the people that are coming in to vote. By the way, I do not have anything prepared. It's just some notes that I put down here. It would speed up election process. It would make it more friendly, and I would say it would make it more secure. Sometimes the polling place is so full of people that you cannot keep track of who is coming and what people are doing. We pass out a little slip of paper once they register, and they walk in and turn that into a ballot. And I could see very easily, as I spend my time, I did not take a break until 10 after 7 in the last election of leaving that room, but I could see very easily when it's crowded, if somebody knew what kind of little pad of paper we're using to pass out, that they could pass out a bunch of those, and people could walk in and get by what's going on and go get a ballot. I don't know if that happens anyplace, but I could see where it could. I have several paraplegic friends. One cousin was paraplegic. He voted every time, never missed an election. I would recommend that you pass photo ID and allow us to move into the 21st century with the technology that we have. Photo ID has been passed in Indiana and has gone through the courts and has been tested there. I suggest that we get out the ironing board and we get out the iron and we work out the problems and get this thing passed and going on so that we can move on to the technology that's available for us today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And per Representative Scalzi's request, we will have that final, I guess it's a tag team of Roberta Blomster and Anna Blomster. And that will sum up, that will conclude our testimony.
Hi, thank my you. Name is Anna Blomster, and thank you for allowing us to come in. We are here strictly on the issue of allowing people under guardianship to vote, and I am Roberta's legal guardian, and I'm going to turn this over to her.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify before you today. My name is Roberta Blomster, and I'm not only a self-advocate, but also a person under guardianship in this state. I'm here today because if House File 210 passes as amended, my right to vote will be gone for good. My mom was my conservator until the state legislation in 2003 put people like me under guardianship. Despite the change, I did vote since the court order did not revoke my right to do so. I worked behind the scenes and also testified here at the Capitol in 2005 on the voter rights bill to make sure that people under guardianship have the right to vote unless the court order revokes that right. I did my research by interviewing fellow clients, self-advocates at Merrick, to find out how they feel about the issue to vote. Many feel that just because we need help with some decision making does not mean we don't understand the voting process. I come prepared to vote whether it's on primary day or election day. I go online using a variety of websites and Facebook, along with information that I get from the Disability Law Center, Advocating Change Together, ARC, Merrick, My Day Train and Habilitation Center, friends and family to make an informed decision about who I want to vote for. I watch debates and read about the candidates. I emailed them about their stand on issues that are important to me. To my friends and family, I am known as their legislative slash voting expert. I used to vote with assistance. Mom would stand by me in case I had any questions regarding what something meant. Sometimes I have problems with the way things are worded. She knows me and how to explain things to me so that I understand it. I now download the sample ballots ahead of time. So I vote by myself using the AutoMark, and that makes me feel really good. I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much for testifying.
Can I just really quickly add that I have been her guardian for almost 17 years now, and she is totally capable of understanding, and I truly believe that what we did in 2005 in making it a judge's choice, because the judge sees the paperwork, they see the clients, they understand the capability of that person under guardianship, and I would like the law to stand as it is now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will move on to the Honorable Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for this opportunity. House File 89 and House File 210 create two additional requirements and two additional barriers for voting that are not included in Minnesota's Constitution. First, you could not vote in Minnesota unless you registered with the government for the purposes of being issued a photo identification card. Second, you could no longer vote in Minnesota unless you were able to present this card at the time of casting a ballot. There are differences in the two bills, but these two additional barriers to voting beyond the Constitution are included in both. There are exceptions. The first is religious exception. The second is the creation of a provisional ballot process. You've heard some testimony about that before. And the Federal Department of Justice has also quite a bit of information about provisional balloting as well. House File 210 is actually an omnibus election bill. It's a much more complicated bill. It contains hundreds of different changes. It proposes some very extraordinary new systems, somewhat akin to the CRIMNET system we currently have in Minnesota. There isn't time in this short period to really go into that, so I will submit testimony on House File 210 in writing. I'll narrow my comments to House File 89 specifically, given the short amount of time we have today. After each election, I meet with local election officials throughout the state, township officials, school board members, clerks, auditors. I've heard an earful of complaints and concerns about these two pieces of legislation. They've been testifying. They've been sending in materials. I will not attempt to summarize those. I just want to take the time to focus on the things that are specifically related to statewide administration. First, unlike House File 210, House File 89 would stop people from being able to vote by absentee ballot, mail-in, or all-mail ballot precincts under this bill. 12% of our precincts, which are townships, smaller, now vote by mail. About a quarter of a million Minnesotans in presidential years vote by mail and absentee ballot. The language in House File 89 is consistently speaking about any individual wishing to vote. If there is an interest in creating an exemption for that, it needs to be stated. But, of course, that begs the question, what are we doing with this legislation? And it invites the kind of Department of Justice intervention because of the process of creating different classes and categories of voters in Minnesota. You've heard some testimony already about some of the other potential barriers, particularly the high cost of transportation and obtaining documents. Yesterday I was in southeast Minnesota meeting with election officials. A county election official described her mother-in-law, who lives at least a $70 Medi-Cab ride for her to go to potentially obtain an ID. She hasn't had one for over 10 years, and she doesn't have all the documents. And there were story after story of the high cost that this would create, not to mention the high cost of these provisions as unfunded mandates to local divisions of government. We could build into the budget not just the unfunded mandate cost, but the cost of transportation, the cost of obtaining documents. But again, it's already an extremely expensive bill. That would make it either more expensive. Now, some of these requirements that are beyond the constitutional requirements have been passed by other states in state legislation. Missouri comes to mind. They passed almost the same bill. The Missouri Supreme Court unanimously ruled that that bill was unconstitutional because it created different classes of voters. And this problem of creating different classes of voters also is a potential trigger for U.S. Federal Department of Justice intervention, and as was mentioned earlier, is an invitation to the kind of lawsuits I think we want to avoid. But I tend to look at these election laws from the point of view of cost-benefit analysis. What will this cost, and what are we getting for it? Are there real problems, and do these proposals address those real problems? So if the problem that's being promoted, being discussed, is the question of people voting illegally, who are these individuals voting illegally? How many are there? What's the circumstance? What could we do? Would this bill address that? County attorneys are the ones who prosecute illegal voting in our state. They give us reports. Of course, in each election year, it's a little bit different, but generally in each major election year, they report that it's a handful of people prosecuted. Almost all are felons who voted prior to the time of their sentence being expired. In 2008, I think we had a very famous case up on War Road, a young man who was out of prison, wanted to get his life back together, called his parole officer, said, hey, left him a message, said, hey, I'm going to vote, I'm getting my life together. He was very enthusiastic about Senator McCain, Senator Coleman. He went down, the parole officer got the message too late, called him, said, no, don't. The young man said, what do you mean don't? Nobody told me I couldn't vote. And the parole officer said, you can't vote. He went back to jail. His life got disrupted. It cost the county a lot of money because he was not told. Would a photo ID have made any difference? Of course not. Nobody's license is now, say, felon. You could change the law and put that on everybody's driver's license, but currently it would not have any effect. But the legislature did take some action in this regard. They passed the law, those of you who are here with a strong bipartisan support, to notify through the judges when anyone was convicted, they must tell convicted felons, you've lost your right to vote. Passed with strong bipartisan support. It was vetoed, but it could be brought up again. That would be a cost-benefit analysis that would make sense to really stop one of the things that we've identified are a problem in our election system, the fact that felons are not being told and therefore are voting when they're not legally eligible and costing the counties a tremendous amount of money in the process. But in addition to my concerns about the specifics, the high costs, the disenfranchisement, the potential for unconstitutional rulings and lawsuits, I'm mostly concerned in election legislation that we pay attention to the process by which we come up with these bills. Governor Pawlenty and I didn't always see eye to eye on everything, but I can tell you that we passed incredible election law changes, improvements, by working together, and his line, which he used in public and in veto messages over and over again, was quite clear. It says, election laws set forth rules relating to the fundamental right to vote and the government's administration of those rights. The details of these laws matter, and the manner in which they are adopted as well. Election bills making changes to our election process should be bipartisan. Unfortunately, this bill fails that test. And Governor Pawlenty said this over and over, and he was consistent. He vetoed anything that didn't come to him with bipartisan support, but he supported those things that were developed. He was mirroring Governor Carlson before him, who had the same thing. Carlson's veto letter went like this. Significant changes in election law are too important to be entirely one-sided and lacking in bipartisanship. I believe our new governor will take the same position as the previous governors as well. I can tell you this, that the process that developed the last round of election law changes was difficult. It took a compromise. It took work. But people felt great when it got done. Both Governor Pawlenty and I felt very proud of those changes, especially the ones that helped our servicemen and women be able to vote and vote successfully in the elections. It was a hard-fought battle, but when we got done, we held an incredible press conference with everyone who was part of making that happy. Everyone in the room felt pride, felt great, felt really Minnesotan. I believe that kind of bipartisan process, working together with the kind of group Mansky talked about earlier, putting the ideas together with some technical assistance, we can send bills to the governor that not only we feel pride in, but every single Minnesotan can feel pride in that legislation if we do it in the way the Minnesotans have always done. We've made election law special. We only move it forward with strong bipartisan support in the legislature, and the governors only sign it if it comes meeting that high standard. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and open to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for your time and your comments today. And I agree, we did some very good work over the last couple of years, and your comments on strong bipartisanship struck me. So I'm curious, is there a scenario, is there a form of photo ID that you can support?
Representative Sanders, something that would come forth from a bipartisan group. Last time, I think the chairs of the committees, under some assistance from the Humphrey Institute, brought in local election officials, brought in some people with technology skills. That kind of a bill would be one that we would really feel strongly about, and of course we'd want to participate in that process. People talk pretty far into the future, and you can imagine electronic poll books where the photos and signatures were there. CRIMNAT is a system a little bit like that, but that's, you know, a lot of money and out into the future. For me, the fundamental kind of requirement is that the process where the legislation is developed has the stakeholders on a bipartisan basis, rural and urban, and also the local election officials who are affected. That would be the thing that would be the most important thing to me. We now need to bring our technology experts in because, you know, there's quite a bit of discussion. And, of course, we have to be mindful of the financial limitations of the budget and everything else. But that process in 2009 and 10 over the session was incredibly successful. And I would urge the committee to consider that same process.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, I guess I'm just looking for a little clarification because there is still time in the committee process, this bill has other stops to go. Are there points where you can sit down with your staff and the authors and find some common ground, or is there not a scenario that you believe Minnesota needs photo ID?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Sanders. It took us 6 months to come up with just the little bit of legislation we did last time, but it was hard fought and it took that long to do it. I would say that's what it takes to do bipartisan legislative writing. And, of course, it's not my office. This has to do with all the budget people, both sides of the aisle, urban and rural, the governor's office, the people in Department of Public Safety. So much of what we're talking about really does get to privacy, data practices. There would be a ton of people that would need to be part of the process. And I'm not referring to House File 210. That's a completely different, that's an omnibus bill. But on 89, it would take a tremendous amount of work to pull that all, to pull that all together. But it could be done. We made massive changes in the last couple rounds, but especially in 10, but it took a lot of months to get there. Once there was agreement, it moved very quickly, and the governor was very happy to sign it, but we couldn't do it in a couple weeks.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, thank you for your testimony today and making yourself available. As you know, that this is an issue that many Minnesotans and folks across the nation have a big concern about. It polls very well that this is an area people do have some concerns with. And I heard you responding to Representative Sanders' questions more about the process and how that would work. I'd like to take it one step back. Do you see from your office any benefits of having a photo ID program to help you better enforce Minnesota's state laws as relates to election and to be able to preserve the integrity of the election process? Thank you.
Madam Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, almost every single illegal voter is a felon voter. Photo ID would require presenting of a photo ID that would have no information on that, so the answer would be no.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, we've heard about Indiana's voter ID. Do you know how many states have a voter ID system with photos?
Mr. Ritchie.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, Georgia and Indiana have the two, I'd say, relatively similar to what's being proposed in House Fight 89. Missouri passed it. It was declared unconstitutional. A couple of the states have, you know, different kind of versions, and some states are looking at legislation right this moment. Texas comes to mind, Arizona as well. Indiana and Georgia are the two that I'm familiar with, and they're quite interesting models, because in Georgia, there was such a, you know, was declared unconstitutional several times, and Department of Justice weighed in, and so they developed a series of public outreach, advertising. They have mobile photo ID provisions. They spend tens of millions of dollars to meet the requirements. And, of course, the Constitution of Georgia is quite different than the state constitution of Minnesota. It reflects a different region of the country and a different point of view about enfranchisement and disenfranchisement. So Georgia spent a pretty good amount of money sort of comply with what were the concerns that were raised about their particular one. Indiana as well, they've done, I think, an excellent job, but spent a tremendous amount of money to do the publicity. And, of course, the Indiana law was quite controversial because so many nuns were disenfranchised, and that made the newspapers. And so Indiana had to react quickly to such negative publicity, and I think they've done a good job of reacting to that. Those are the two that, you know, are the, you know, kind of the closest that are in play.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, just concentrating on Indiana a little bit more then, and perhaps you don't, you're not aware of any statistics there, but were there any dramatic changes in the percent voting there? You mentioned the nuns. Any other, you know, particular problems that you're aware of that happened that kept people from voting in Indiana?
Madam Chairman, Madam Chairman, Representative Erdahl, by far the biggest thing was the filing of provisional ballots. You created a kind of a nightmare for local election officials, and a huge percent of the people who cast provisional ballots couldn't get back in time. So the provisional ballots are the things that have been the subject of academic studies in Indiana. But I don't really pay close attention to it because we don't have provisional ballots in Minnesota, and I think people have consistently resisted the sort of chaos that creates for local election officials. You heard some testimony about this before. I think Indiana's experience played out that the fears people have about provisional ballots as a nightmare for local election officials, not to mention for voters. I think 30% of provisional ballots in the country are ever cast. 70% are never cast or never allowed to be cast. I think the concerns that Minnesotans have expressed about provisional balloting over the years are certainly justified by the experience of Indiana that's reported in the academic media and in the kind of the review materials.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, just following up on that, once again, in Indiana, did you notice or were there reports of any significant changes in voter turnout?
Mr. Ritchie.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl. Yes, with Sarah Palin on the ballot and Barack Obama, they had a big jump in turnout just like the rest of the country. Was it due to photo ID? I doubt it. I think it had to do with an energized base. But advocates of photo ID make the argument that photo ID will increase the turnout. And further, they make the argument that all of this publicity, much of it not based on substantiated evidence, has made Minnesotans no longer trust their system, and our voting has gone down. And that is not substantiated in Minnesota by anything from polling to election data. With all the publicity of the recount and all the accusations of, you know, kind of outrageous things that were said that were not true, not only did Minnesota lead the nation again in the last election, but we widen our spread over the number two state, which happens to be Wisconsin, from 5% to 6%. So what we know is that the accusation that Minnesotans don't trust their system is simply not supported by the fact that we're typically and remain the top voting state in the nation, and we have widened our spread over the number two state in the last election. I don't pretend to speak for Indiana. It's sort of not my business, and I don't pay any attention, and I don't visit Indiana, and I don't know a lot about Indiana, and asking a question about Indiana seems like a line of questioning that might be better put to people from Indiana. But Minnesota, people say to me, we have to have photo ID because no one trusts our elections. And I look around the room and I say, 80% of you voted, number one in the nation. Those cheeseheads fell from 5 to 6% behind us. We can't beat them in football, but we can beat them in voting. So Minnesotans must trust our system.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, how many same-day registrants were there in 08 and 10?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, 560. Just a moment. People much more intelligent than me know these things. Madam Chair, Representative Quam, 560 and 210. So 560,000, that's a big presidential year. 210,000 in 2010. Part of that reduction was the difference in the voting, of course. But part of that reduction is that the legislature authorized the use of U.S. Postal Service change of address databases so that addresses could be updated automatically. Something about 80% of same-day registrations are simply changing address. Almost all of them are done there on the spot. And so by using U.S. Postal Service data, we've been able to reduce the number of people who just have to stand in line again. We've been able to bring that down. But 210,000, I have asked specifically county auditors and city clerks, did the change of address feature help reduce same-day registrations? And they said yes.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, since you brought up addresses, it is the practice to verify addresses. And in 08, what percent of addresses were not verifiable for the same-day registrants?
Mr. Ritchie.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, the number that we got back, they don't come to us, they come to counties. I've asked the counties, they said it's been more or less the exact same number. You know, we have about 15% of Minnesotans that move every year, so, you know, it's going to be in that quantity. But also, any address that's not verified is turned over to county attorneys for additional investigation if it can't be determined it's a verifiable address. And there were zero prosecutions of anyone from that providing of information, so it must be that all were verifiable at the end of the day.
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Mr. Secretary, information I have was that approximately 5% were not verifiable addresses, which would be in the order of tens of thousands, some of those being not valid or not residential addresses, and that being several orders of magnitude greater than the margin that selected our present junior senator. I think that has some of the concern why it may be an electronic roll or some improvement, of which I believe last year or the year before you had commented that that would be a great help in a press release. But I also, so that is part of my concern about the integrity of the election system. The other one I have is that there were, and you were quoted by a couple of small local papers, the Strib and Pioneer Press, about 2 years ago, that there were tens of thousands of more votes cast than what the total in the voter rolls. And, you know, that's another thing that adds to my concern about the election integrity. And are there elements of these two bills that would help alleviate some of those concerns?
Mr. Ritchie.
Madam Chair, Representative, so let's break these apart. I've heard these unbelievable claims about bad address voting, like you've heard as well. I was told that thousands of dead people voted, and I asked and asked and asked for names, and somebody came up with a list of five, and all were bogus, you know. So what we do when somebody makes a kind of an outlandish claim, we say, okay, well, where did this fact come from? And so in the case of PVC cards or postal verification cards, which is the source, we would say, okay, who gets postal verification cards? The counties. Let's call the counties and ask them how many actually came back, you know, because people make unbelievable claims about election stuff. And then we would say, now, is that an unusual number? And then we would say, what do you do with the ones that you can't verify the address? Do you turn over to the county attorney? They say yes, and then we say, were there any prosecutions? They say no, they investigated them, there weren't. So I would be very happy to call or write all 87 counties and say, look, in 2008, do you have your records? What were the number of postal verification cards that came back? In fact, maybe there's enough county auditors here in the room today that you could just report on this particular thing to get to the bottom of this, and then we could give you an exact number. But I do think that the way that people say out loud things that aren't true about our elections does affect how some people view it. For example, one of the attorneys in the last in the big recount said that the election director had 32 ballots in her trunk. It was a lie from the first moment it was told. Hubbard Broadcast and KSTP debunked it immediately. All the papers have debunked it over and over again, but it continues to be repeated. So we like to get to the bottom of things, and this is one particular one I'd be happy to go further on. I'd like to switch to the paraphrasing of things that were reported in the newspaper. What I said was that in our voting file, in our SVRS system, there are many different things that are entered in that system, and they don't have anything to do with the number of voters. And we don't use the voting rights, the SVRS system, to reconcile voters. They're done in the precinct at night. They must be exactly matched at night or an explanation. And so the attempt to sort of put words in my mouth and attempt to report that implies that there were more voters than voting people who were allowed to vote, and that that somehow was a way of stealing the election, the Senate race, is something that we work hard to say, well, let's take a look at what those statistics are, and let's be very careful about implying that these elections were stolen. I would repeat what every single lawyer for the Coleman, Franken recount for both teams said. We had $20 million. We had unlimited investigators and reporters. And lawyers, all kinds of people looking at this. Did we find any fraud? Asked by the Supreme Court, they said no, not a whiff. Asked on television very recently, one of the main lawyers said, you know, we really wanted to find fraud, but we could find none. So I think when people who are at the center of a recount, the lawyers, say out loud, we looked and looked and we didn't find it, that then creates a kind of an atmosphere that we need to take quite seriously, so that when somebody else says that election was stolen, we say, you know, that's really not what the Supreme Court, the three appeal judges, all the lawyers for both sides said. So let's look into this a little bit further. And I would be happy to sit down in any situation and to go through whatever numbers people want to present and try to get to the bottom of it, because we deal in facts.
Okay, members, I don't want to cut anyone off. If you could maybe wrap up, Representative Quam, and maybe a succinct answer, because we do have quite a lot of work that we still have to do today. So while this is very good information, I think we've been on, Mr. Secretary, for about 25 minutes. So Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Mr. Secretary, my understanding is that all that information in your quotes were after the recount was settled in 08. But if you can get some of these data to me, and I assume that the committee, my aim was that if we had the electronic roll, then we'd have this information more instantaneously, and we wouldn't have to worry about these questions and the drag out. And that was, I was hoping you'd respond to that, but thank you for your responses.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will respond in writing, and also I'll give you my vision of where the electronic poll books do fit when our budget is, you know, the budget situation is better, because I have a high degree of interest in this, and we've helped do a couple pilot projects on it already. And so I have some specific ideas, and I'll provide it to you, and then CC it to everybody else. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Frazier has a closing comment, I think.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I just want to note that we will be presenting this committee with a report on March 1st about the number of postal verification cards returned after the 2010 election and the numbers turned over to county attorneys because the eligibility of the voters could not be verified. So that data will be coming to this committee shortly. Thank you
very much for your testimony.
Thank you very
Secretary.
Much, Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer, if you could come forward. I promised on Thursday I would allow the video today. We are very short on time, so if you could perhaps either maybe shorten up your closing comments so that we can watch the video, that would be greatly appreciated. We do have several amendments, and I still want to allow adequate time for questions from members since we've had questions for the witnesses, but we haven't had questions to the bill from members, and I want to allow that. So if you could wrap it up quickly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today and to present the bill, House File 210. I'm State Representative Mary Kiffmeyer, and I appreciate the opportunity also to hear from the testifiers, many of which I've been meeting with separately. To smooth out the language as well. And certainly for Mr. Bell, I appreciate your good comments. And it's been a 24-48-hour turnaround, but we'll continue to work to make sure that the language meets the federal voting rights law and is to your satisfaction as well. In addition, also, I am a guardian for my sister. I understand what it is to be a guardian, and this is what brought up my concerns with the current statute. Nonetheless, between the constitutional statement that someone under guardianship is not eligible nor shall be permitted to vote, we have an issue with the Minnesota Constitution and the language and statute. So again, as this section has brought out, as they said, issues that they've known about for a few years. There have been some language things that they've not been real happy about, and we've been trying to work them through. And so I suspect we will continue to work out that language, and I have amendment as an effort towards that direction today, but we will continue to work that forward as well. On the absentee ballot, just to let you know that there is an identity, there's a witness issue that goes on an absentee ballot, and because of the uniqueness of military voters, their identity issues, those who need to do an absentee ballot are very, very different. So I think that those are addressing some of the issues that we have here and some of the amendments that I have as well. With that, Madam Chair, I would just like to show the 10-minute video, and then we also have just a 1 minute of the equipment.
Thank you very much.
A lot changed during the 20th century. Advancements in technology enabled dramatic improvements in terms of the speed, cost, and quality of business and government operations. Portions of Minnesota's election system took advantage of these technological developments, including how voter registration records were stored and how ballots were tabulated. However, much of today's election system still remains unchanged from the time of the early 20th century. A 21st century voter ID bill has been introduced in the Minnesota State Legislature. The objective of this bill is to modernize our election system in order to improve the integrity, efficiency, and effectiveness of Minnesota's elections. Let's take a moment and compare today's election system to some of the changes proposed in the 21st century voter ID bill. Today, when a voter enters a polling place, they are typically directed to one of two different queues, one for pre-registered voters and one for unregistered voters who wish to register to vote on Election Day. Unregistered voters must wait in line to fill out a voter registration form. During busy periods, a person may need to wait 30 minutes or more to complete a voter registration. Election judges routinely report instances of people becoming frustrated with the wait times and leaving the polling place without voting. Voters registering on Election Day must use one of three methods to confirm their identity and their address. First, they may present an approved form of photo identification. Second, they may provide a recent utility bill that includes their current address. Or third, they may have a registered voter from the precinct accompany them to vouch for their identity and their residence. Individuals who lack one of these three forms of identification are turned away from voting.
This approach to identity verification has some problems. In vouching, for example, one person can vouch for up to 15 people in a single election. Poll watchers routinely report stories of individuals attempting to vouch for multiple individuals who they apparently don't even know. There have also been reports of individuals attempting to use forged utility bills in order to register to vote. After the election, handwritten voter registration forms must be data entered into the Statewide Voter Registration System, or SVRS. State and federal law requires that these new registrations be immediately entered. However, some counties are consistently late in meeting these statutory deadlines, often requiring 6 months or more to complete the data entry. After the registration forms have been entered into SVRS, a postal verification card, or PVC, is printed and mailed to every newly registered voter as a means of verifying their identity and their address. In a typical statewide election, upwards of 500,000 PVCs are printed and mailed. If these cards were piled on top of one another, the stack would be taller than a 30-story office building. If a postal verification card is not returned as undeliverable by the Postal Service, the newly registered voter is deemed to be valid. Return cards must be data entered so that the voter's registration can be flagged and challenged in the next election. Now keep in mind that this verification step is not completed until several weeks after the election has already taken place and the individual's ballot has been cast and counted. In 2008, there were over 23,000 postal verification cards from Election Day registrations that were returned as undeliverable by the Postal Service. Including the return cards from pre-election registrants, the number increases to over 32,000 undeliverable cards. A sampling of these return cards revealed voter registration addresses that include sections of freeway, empty lots, city parks, business warehouses, and non-existent house numbers. Keep in mind that this occurred in a year in which several major election battles were decided by just a few hundred votes. One other point to keep in mind is that there's currently no eligibility verification performed for voters who register to vote on Election Day. Individuals may be ineligible to vote for a variety of reasons, including felons who are still on parole, non-citizens, individuals who are under guardianship, or out-of-state residents. A review of 2008 election records revealed thousands of ineligible voters that may have participated in the 2008 election. It took nearly 2 years for these persons to be identified. And keep in mind again that these individuals' ballots had already been cast and counted. Now let's go back and look at the Election Day process for pre-registered voters. Voters who enter the polling place line up by last name at the check-in table. Each voter signs in on an election roster. The roster is a list of all registered voters in the precinct. The list includes the person's name, address, and provides a place for the voter to sign in. Pre-registered voters are not currently required to present any form of identification. In today's system, a dishonest individual could travel from one precinct to another and sign in on any random line in an election roster, thereby voting multiple times in a single election. After the election, election officials scan a barcode next to the names of persons who have signed in on the roster, recording the fact that they voted in the election. This information is captured within the statewide voter registration system. Past experience has shown that election officials can make mistakes by scanning the wrong lines on the roster. This has resulted in people being recorded as having voted when they actually did not, including deceased individuals. Mistakes such as these not only impact the integrity of our election records, but also can adversely impact whether a voter registration continues to remain on the rolls. Now let's compare today's election system to the proposed changes included in the 21st Century Voter ID Bill. Let's begin with the Election Day registration process.
New registrants will present their driver's license or state-issued identification card. The card will be swiped in a card reader. Information from the card will be electronically captured, and the voter's eligibility to vote will be immediately verified. The system will also automatically confirm that the individual is in the correct polling place. If not, it will print a map and directions to the appropriate polling place where the individual should vote. Data from the individual's identification card will automatically populate a voter registration form that is then printed and signed by the voter. The voter's registration information will be stored in the electronic poll book and uploaded to the SVRS system later that day. If an individual lacks an identification card, they will still be allowed to vote using a provisional ballot.
no one will be turned away from the polls, which is currently the case for individuals who lack the appropriate form of identification. Individuals who use a provisional ballot to vote will be required to return to their local city or county office within 10 days after the election to confirm their identity and eligibility with a proper form of identification. The long lines of people waiting to manually complete a voter registration form will be a thing of the past. People who wish to register on election day will no longer simply give up on voting due to wait times. Since new voter registrations are electronically transferred to SVRS on election day, election workers will no longer need to spend hundreds of hours after the election to manually enter handwritten voter registration forms into SVRS. This will not only reduce errors, but also enable officials to comply with existing laws requiring the timely entry of new voter registrations. Gone, too, is the requirement for counties to print and mail postal verification cards to newly registered voters. The voter's identity and residence will be confirmed before they are given a ballot instead of after the fact. Now let's examine the process for registered voters. Individuals will present their driver's license or state identification card to an election official when checking in to vote. The election official will swipe the individual's card. The system will then automatically check to confirm the voter's eligibility to vote and record the fact that the person has voted. The voter's information will be automatically transferred to SVRS. All of this will occur in a matter of seconds. Gone is the need to print thousands of paper roster pages prior to election day. Gone is the need for voters to page through a paper roster looking for the appropriate line on which to sign in. Gone is the chance that someone could vote under another person's identity. Gone is the opportunity for someone to vote when they are ineligible to do so. And gone is the need for election officials to scan rosters after the election in order to record that the individuals had voted. Now let's recap the major benefits of the 21st Century Voter ID proposal. First, the proposal improves the integrity of our elections by verifying each voter's identity and eligibility before they are given a ballot, not after. Second, the new system eliminates millions of dollars in wasteful government spending by eliminating the printing of thousands of pages of election rosters, the data entry of 500,000 voter registration forms, the printing and mailing of thousands of postal verification cards, and the scanning of thousands of pages of election rosters. Third, it speeds up the voting process, thereby eliminating the possibility for people to become disenfranchised and giving up and trying to vote due to long lines. Fourth, the proposal improves the timeliness and accuracy of information used to administer our elections due to the elimination of manual data entry. Fifth, the new system eliminates the possibility of a voter being turned away from the polls due to a lack of appropriate credentials through the use of provisional ballots. Finally, and possibly most important, the proposal improves public confidence in our election system. States that have implemented similar systems have seen an increase in their voter participation. 21st Century Voter ID is a proposal whose time has come in the state of Minnesota. Please contact your elected officials and urge them to support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then also, I do have the equipment here today and have a demonstration of the equipment.
Can that be rather quick, Representative Kiffmeyer? And while they're getting that set up, it's becoming obvious to me that we are not going to be able to get to the second bill today. And I think we will take that up tomorrow and move back the agenda for tomorrow and take it up right away tomorrow, if that is okay with you, Representative Benson.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick demonstration here. You have a driver's license card. In this case, it's just a scanner. It shows, as you can see up on the screen, it finds the voter record. Then, as the election judge reviews the ID of the voter and compares that, and then a printed receipt of which the receipt then is able to be signed by the voter. It's like a mini roster, and it is then given to the ballot judge in exchange for a ballot. It's just that simple and just that quick. I thought sometimes having a video of the entire system, and here's a chance just to see what an actual piece of equipment would use. This is very common equipment. But back again, if I could, Madam Chair, to the actual bill itself on the photo ID presentation. My comments are that I'm glad to see that Secretary Ritchie is interested in the electronic rosters and that there are some processes that need to be worked out. I would look forward to doing that as we did before a legislative task force. We could pass this bill, and in my discussions with them, that we've put a lot of detail already in this bill, but that we have another legislative session and a report could be prepared for the next legislative session. The last time when we did a legislative task force, we did it without statutory authority. Amazing thing. We were able to just get together and spend a lot of time in having that conversation, and I will look forward to that with the advent of the passing of this bill as well. I think it is important to realize that, once again, there's an opposition to the photo ID component, and I would just like to briefly, I know that we do have other amendments and other items to get to, but I would just read to you what the court said, because I've heard some of these concerns and objections. They're not unusual, but the U.S. Supreme Court, by vote of 6-3, voted in favor of the constitutionality of Indiana's photo ID law. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote in the majority opinion that the relevant burdens here are those imposed on eligible voters who lack photo identification cards that comply with the Indiana law. Because Indiana's cards are free, the inconvenience of going to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, gathering required documents, and posing for a photograph does not qualify as a substantial burden on most voters' right to vote, or represent a significant increase over the usual burdens of voting. The severity of the somewhat heavier burden that may be placed on a limited number of persons, for example, elderly born out of state who may have difficulty obtaining a birth certificate, is mitigated by the fact that eligible voters without photo ID may cast provisional ballots that will be counted if they execute the required affidavit at the clerk's office. Even assuming that the burden may not be justified as to a few voters, that conclusion is by no means sufficient to establish petitioners' right to the relief they seek. For these members, it was critical that the individuals and groups challenging the Indiana law could not produce a single voter who was unable to comply with the law's requirements and was disenfranchised as a result. These justices noted that this is an important position. And I read this to you because if you have an Indiana Supreme Court and then you have a U.S. Supreme Court with all the heightened interest that they could not find one single documented case of a voter who was disenfranchised by this photo ID law, then I think that is a very close scrutiny that we can look forward to. And certainly any of the issues that voters have brought up to me, those languages as we go forward will be worked out. And I appreciate that. I think it always is amazing to me. They use the example of the end of the voting process, of the recounting, as if that was the same as registration, and it is not. The act of registration, the act of getting a ballot, is an initial part of the process. Those who actually get a ballot and then recounting that at the end of the process. But certainly, focusing on the integrity in elections, Minnesota had the highest voter turnout in the state for the 8 years while I was Secretary of State and my focus, and I assure you there were many unkind words said about me as Secretary of State during those 8 years. And yet still, by focusing on the integrity in the elections process and a lot of communication from my office as well, we had the highest voter turnout in the country, and we had lots of issues. Every election always has a good reason for voters to come out and vote, and we certainly had those in those 8 years as well. With that, Madam Secretary, I will not go into further comment on the rest of the bill so that we can get to the amendments.
Thank you. I think at this time I'll open it up for questions to the bill, and I just want to remind members that we did pass the DE1 amendment last Thursday, so we are working from that, and so we'll take a few questions. We do have several amendments, so we'll start with questions. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, before I get to my question, let me just talk a little bit about Indiana. When you and others say that they didn't find a single example of any abuse or disenfranchisement, that's really not the right inquiry. What they did in Indiana in the Supreme Court case was what's called a facial challenge. They didn't wait for an election to take place. They said, on the face of it, without an election, that was the analysis. So we have the example of the nuns and the others in Indiana who were fenced out. So, of course, the Supreme Court didn't find any any examples because there were none to be found. Let me read you from page 11 of the Supreme Court decision, though. Again, this was the majority decision because they were only reviewing whether it was constitutional, not whether it was a good idea, just whether it passed the constitutional test, not yay or nay whether it was good. Quote, the only kind of voter fraud that the bill addresses is in-person voter impersonation at polling places. The record contains no evidence of any such fraud actually occurring in Indiana at any time in its history, end quote. 2 pages later, on page 13, it did say, though, that the justification there was a history of voter fraud throughout Indiana. And they said, quote, Indiana has an unusually inflated list of registered voters, which included thousands of dead people and felons on the voter rolls. So the bill that you claim is the twin of your bill, the Indiana bill, is, in the words of the Supreme Court, one that it is designed to and, in fact, actually only addresses voter impersonation, not felon voting, not any other kind of. So that's what the Supreme Court says. But let me ask you a specific question about vouching, because your bill does away with vouching. You may have heard me say in the prior committee hearing that my own father had only vouching available to him in the 1998 election, where he moved to a new residence in October. The election was in November. He didn't have a utility bill and didn't have a new driver's license. So were it not for vouching, he would have had no options. What do you see is the danger in the system, I guess in any system, but in the voting system with vouching? What is the danger there with vouching? Why is that not a good thing?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Simon. I would take your first comment, the facial challenge. You are correct in regards to a facial challenge. However, the Indiana Supreme Court, after there was an election, twice upheld the Indiana photo ID law. And you are correct that it was a circumstance that took quite a bit of time, actually, to become apparent in regards to the individuals, and that's why I am careful in regard to working with disability communities or others as well to make sure that we include every opportunity for them to be able to vote and to make sure that our language, and that's why I work very hard with them to work on that. In regards to this particular bill, and you're correct that if you only do photo ID, then you only deal with the impersonation issue. But I would go back to what Lucky Rosenblum said, who worked in the criminal justice, saying those who steal don't stand there and say, hey, I'm here, I'm lying, this is not really who I am. You know, the issue of the photo ID is to deter and to prove that. If you don't have that, you really don't know if there's impersonation or not, because you don't have an ID requirement. That's a unique situation. In my bill, though, and that is one reason why with the electronic rosters, last year we worked together in passing legislation that does include the Department of Corrections sending electronic information to the Secretary of State on felon information, death records as well. And so we would be able to have electronic records that would work with the electronic rosters to deal with some of the other issues and the verifications. By the way, this is the kind of thing that everybody else who pre-registers goes through as a normal course of registration. Only on election day do we treat those people who come in on election day as above all the rest of the verification and all the rest of the laws, and that there they can just jump ahead of everything else, not go through it on prior to casting a ballot. And so you have this group of voters registering ahead of time, going through this standard, and these on election day having a different kind of standard. And so I think that every single voter should know about what it is, and it's a qualified right. You need to be 18 by election day, need to be a citizen, you have residency. It's not just you have a right to vote no matter your age. So I think my bill does deal in a little bit more comprehensive way with some of the other issues that I think the video illustrated. And so the danger of vouching is mainly that it is a faith-based system. We should just trust you at face value that you're being honest that day, while other voters who have been pre-registered don't go through. That is why we have the provisional ballots that make sure that an eligible voter who's entitled to that vote, such as your father might have been that case, would be able to cast a provisional ballot. I think we're putting a lot on our voters on election day at requiring them to sort through utility bills, tax statements, lists of vouchers, 15 here, other things. We're putting a lot inside this polling place with our election judges. Using technology and using provisional ballots, I think we structure the process to treat the voters on Election Day in the same sort of way that anybody else who registers before Election Day goes through.
Okay, Representative Simon has a follow-up, and perhaps you can keep the answers a little shorter, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate that phrase, and it's a memorable one, that vouching is a faith-based system, that we're really counting on people, which is why I was interested to note, and I just learned this yesterday, that under current Minnesota law, it's, and I pass it out to committee members, 4601.2600, subpart 6, if you want to get a birth certificate in Minnesota, yours or someone else's, you can use vouching. You can't make this stuff up, folks. You can right now, to get a birth certificate that you would need to get the photo ID in both bills today, you can be vouched for. In subpart 6 and subpart 7, subpart 6 says that if someone's known you for 2 years and you go in and you want to get a birth certificate and you don't have ID, they can vouch for you. So that faith-based system is already in law, in administrative rule, and if anyone in Minnesota wants to get a birth certificate, they can be vouched for. So that faith-based system, Representative Kiffmeyer, is already alive and well, and I don't know if your next bill will be to outlaw that, but right now in Minnesota, any one of us who wants to get ours or another's birth certificate under certain circumstances can be vouched for if they don't have verification. How do you respond to that?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Simon and members. Without a doubt, there are issues that have been ongoing in regards to our identity system, birth records, and others that since 9/11, the Real ID Act, there are a variety of federal legislation that has been introduced, and there have been concerns addressed about the ease of which people are able to get a birth record, and there are questions about that. But you are correct that my bill does not go farther than Minnesota election law, but thank you for pointing that out. I'll make sure, and by the way, that's a rule, not a statute. I don't know if you have a statutory reference derived for that as well that I think we as a legislature should consider.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's 1 minute to noon, and we've had about 8 minutes for members to get involved. I assume we're taking action another time.
Well, my intention was to go 15 minutes over, and I thought we'd be able to get through it today. I do know there are some amendments, and if we need to do that, I know another committee's coming in at 12:30. If we are not done by, say, 12:15, 12:20, we will have to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess, a question. Representative Kiffmeyer, you've talked about the U.S. constitutional decision, which was a plurality decision, not a majority decision. And they listed a number of factors that mitigated the Indiana law. And you mentioned the Indiana Supreme Court, but we haven't really talked very much about the Minnesota Constitution. I think that most people would agree that voting is a fundamental right, as we heard the other day. It's the subject of more constitutional amendments than any other right that we have. And the Minnesota Constitution, I pass this out for everyone, is instructive. It's Article 7. The Section 1 says, every person 18 years of age or more who's been a citizen of the United States for 3 months who has resided in the precinct for 30 days shall be entitled to vote in that precinct. Then it goes on to list in Section 1 the people who shall not be entitled or permitted to vote, and that is convicted of treason or a felony, under guardianship, or a person who is insane or not mentally competent. And then Section 3, I think, is even more relevant, because what they did when they wrote the Constitution was to put in the Constitution a faith-based system, as you described it. Section 3 says, the legislature shall provide for a uniform oath or affirmation to be administered at elections, and no person shall be compelled to take any other or different form of oath to entitle him to vote. So we have a system. It says you shall be entitled to vote if you meet the requirements listed in Section 1, unless you're one of these groups of people listed in Section 1. And then the Constitution provides a mechanism for ensuring that only people who are entitled to vote do in fact vote, and that mechanism is an oath. It's the affidavit that you sign under penalty of a felony. And I think that any attempt to put a photo ID requirement to law is stepping beyond the bounds of Article 7, and in fact would open this law to a very real and plausible constitutional challenge under the state constitution. And there has been no precedent whatsoever supporting a photo ID requirement under the state constitution. And it's right that it should be so. How many other fundamental rights do we have that you have to first prove to the government who you are before you can exercise them? We have a First Amendment that guarantees the freedom of religion. We have a First Amendment that guarantees the freedom of speech. And do we have to prove when we go to church that we're a citizen protected by the First Amendment and show an ID to get in? Do we have to do that to go to the public square and spout off whatever kind of wisdom or nonsense that we might have in our minds at the time? We don't have to do that. We don't have to prove to the government who we are in order to exercise a fundamental right. And I don't understand why voting should be treated differently. Voting is not like buying alcohol or buying cigarettes. Voting is not like getting on an airplane or doing any of these other activities. Voting is a right that is guaranteed to an individual person. It is their individual fundamental right. And the concept of placing these additional restrictions goes beyond the Minnesota Constitution, and it really violates the very essence of what a fundamental right is. It's to protect the individual against the majority. No matter how popular a photo ID provision is, the fact that the Constitution protects individuals from that kind of majority action is the very purpose for having those rights in the first place.
Did you want to respond to that, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. I think the real key here is that it is a fundamental right, but even in the Constitution, it gives qualifications, and it also gives to the legislature to do the uniform oath. And it does not state the oath in the Constitution. It gives it to the legislature to do that. So that would just be my own comment in the interest of brevity.
Okay, Representative Erdahl, you had a comment as well.
A real quick one, Madam Chair. First of all, I'm not in favor of disenfranchising anyone's right to vote. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that, you know, historically, who can vote in America has changed. We started out, white men over 21 who owned land were the only people who could vote. And that this has been an evolving process in this country. And so, I mean, there is no, you know, particular guarantee that things don't change in the future, but once again, you know, it's an important right. We shouldn't disenfranchise people, but it's changed.
Representative Erdahl, or Representative Beard, you had a comment as well?
I want to thank Representative Winkler for the thoughtful discussion about voting and about the right to vote. Just a couple observations, maybe for the sake of the debate, as we consider this sober topic here. And a couple of them popped to mind. I'm not a lawyer. I never even played one in high school play one time. But when we talk about rights, the right that's enumerated in Article 7 does have qualifiers on it, unlike the natural rights which accrue to us for life and freedom of religion and freedom of speech and so on. And I don't want to plow real deep with natural rights versus civil rights, but it seems to me that there are some attendant responsibilities with the right to vote. Because my right to live, just exist, doesn't impact Representative Winkler at all. My right to live is only attendant on him not killing me. And government exists to, of course, help that not happen or prosecute him if he does. But voting is a little different. Because I have a right to vote. Representative Winkler has a right to vote, I would submit. His vote is impacted if I commit fraud while I'm doing my vote. If, for instance, I don't like Representative Winkler, so I bring a busload of friends to his precinct and vote for the other candidate in the next election, his right to vote is impacted. And I think then that we have, as legislators, government, who are interested in preventing fraud and bringing as much transparency to the process as possible, we should thoughtfully weigh measures that help us not only honor the trust that each voter has by exercising that civil right, but also giving the government tools to help ensure the verification. So I guess to get back to the old adage of trust, yes, we trust, yes, we take the oath, but there needs to be and should be some easy verification process to make sure that those of us that maybe don't have such noble standards as Representative Winkler don't violate that trust and then impinge on his civil right to vote. I think we should take that into account, too, while we're weighing these measures.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, just my response would be that there are limits on this fundamental right, just like there are limits on every other right. There might be, you can have a debate about natural rights, but there are limits on freedom of speech as well. And those limits are very carefully prescribed in the Constitution. They're not to be messed with. And the point I'm trying to make is that it's an individual's right to vote. And the Constitution says that they shall be entitled to, and then it lists some exceptions. Those exceptions should be very narrowly construed, because if you begin to read in more broadly into those exceptions, you begin to fence more people out of the voting process and remove more of those individuals' rights as defined in the Constitution.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions to the DE1 amendment? If not, we do have some amendments that we can start with and see where we get to. Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have, I understand there are a few amendments here that might have your name attached to them. Is the A1 amendment?
Yes.
Your amendment? Okay. Representative Murray will move the A1 amendment. Perhaps you could quickly describe it, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the E1 amendment, I would just like to state I would like this amendment to go on today and ask for your support, but I also know that there are folks that I want to work with to smooth this language out some more, but I would like, this way everybody has the current version of the language to work from. And then between now and the next committee, I'm going to have a series of meetings with the community, and I want to get them in the room. We've been trying to do this through email and other things, but we need to just get together in the room with a chalkboard, a whiteboard, with verbal repeating, whatever tools it takes, so that we can get the language exactly as we want it to be. But I would just like to ask for your support and place this amendment on today so that we all have the working draft to go from.
Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just ask for a roll call on the amendment.
Okay, there has been a roll call requested. Are there any other questions to the amendment? Okay. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
Aye.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard?
Aye.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Sanders?
Aye.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Erdahl?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Let's move on quickly to, and I think we can probably do another 10 minutes or so. Let's move on quickly to the A2 amendment. I understand that is also an author's amendment.
Yes, correct? Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Murray will move the A2 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, this is another section that I am working with the disability community and also the long-term care nursing homes, and as of today, I did not receive a response to them in regards to this language, whether it is sufficient. So at this time, I will pull this language until I am able to get their input on it.
Okay. The next amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winkler?
Can I offer the A6 amendment, please?
Representative Winkler moves the A6 amendment to your amendment, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, members, the A6 amendment deals with the vouching that's eliminated in House File 210. It reinstates existing state law regarding vouching, specifically with respect to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, veteran homes, facilities with people who are disabled, battered women shelters, and shelters for the homeless. Page 2, the last two paragraphs provide that individuals who have to retrieve supporting documentation in order to get a photo ID. So if you have to go and get a birth certificate or if you have to go get a marriage certificate, the state will pay for those things. So that if this is going to be a free ID, this should truly be a free ID. The goal here, Madam Chair and members, is to deal with the some of the testimony that we've heard from elderly folks, especially, and the particular burden that they face in not being able to get the free ID because of the documentation and the fact that many of them, it simply won't work, and that the system of vouching is trustworthy in those residential housing type facilities. So, Madam Chair, I'd urge adoption of the A6 amendment.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer, would you like to comment on the A6 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, I will ask for members to not support this amendment, as I had my amendment as well and withdrew it because I have not had the responses from the long-term care folks in regards to my own amendment language to work with them in regards to the language. I would prefer to bring forth language that is agreed to by them and that has gone through the process. And so I would like to have this language not adopted today and would ask you to not support the A6 amendment.
Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Are there any other discussions or questions to the A6 amendment? Hearing none, clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin.
No.
Representative Murray.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Nay.
Representative Green.
Yes.
Representative Hancock.
Nay.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative McFarland.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Sanders.
No.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Still have time for a little bit more.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
I have the A5 amendment I'd like to move.
Representative Hornstein moves the A5 amendment to the amendment. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This basically just preserves the status quo in existing law with regard to guardianship. We heard very compelling testimony from Roberta Blumster earlier today, a very well-informed voter who would be denied her right to vote under this bill, so this restores that. And then we also, the second line, 1.4, relates to the testimony we heard from Christopher Bell earlier from the American Council on the Blind. Again, it restores our existing status quo. I thought he made some excellent points about the overreach of government in terms of deciding who gets to assist people with disabilities. So I would move that amendment and ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Kiffmeyer, would you like to comment on the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. And I had considered doing such an amendment myself, actually, Representative Hornstein, because of the time to work out the language on some of these issues. And you can do two ways. You can delete the language in and work on it and bring forward an amendment to the next hearing, or you can delete the section and work on it and bring it forward at the next meeting. So, Madam Chair, at this time, I would ask for the support of the members on the A5 amendment.
Support of the members?
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd withdraw the roll call on that.
Representative Hornstein withdraws the roll call. Are there any other? I guess there's no other questions. So, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion does prevail, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair,
Representative Green.
I'd like to move on Amendment A7, please.
Representative Green moves the A7 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Green?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Essentially, this amendment allows an employee of a shelter at a battered women's shelter to vouch for a resident of that shelter. The first paragraph, which is lines 1.7 to 1.18, the shelter has provided a list of employees to the polling location, or in lines 1.20 to 1.25, an employee can take the oath about their employment at the polling location in order to assist a resident in voting.
Representative Kiffmeyer, do you want to comment on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Green amendment. And members. Thank you for bringing forward this. But one of the things that I thought I would comment to the members that some that are here are new and others, that in 2006, while I was Secretary of State, we brought forward a program called Address Confidentiality. It was called the Safe at Home Program, administered by the Secretary of State Office. And in particular, it included a feature in there that was allowing voting by these participants. And in particular, there was lots of testimony at the time from battered women or those who had had this kind of abuse that they feared coming to the polling place to vote on election day. And that by coming to the polling place, they exposed themselves, their name, their address, their identity, and that was a risk for them. And so the Safe at Home, the voting program participant here is 5B.06, where the person that is in a situation like this is able to register with the Secretary of State as an ongoing absentee voter with a very special kind of address, a P.O. box, and a very special process that was very quickly done and enabled them to vote an absentee ballot and protect their identity. So, you know, I was just a little bit unsure in this situation whether actually coming to the polling place and stating their name and putting down their actual living address was a safe way, because certainly the whole point of the voting through the Safe at Home program was to protect women who would be in these situations. Now, I went on the Secretary of State website on the Safe at Home program under the FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions section.
Excuse me. Representative Kiffmeyer, I hate to interrupt you, but I think we only have one or two more amendments, and we might be able to finish today. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think it would be probably in our best interest if we could move on, and if you could just...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will expedite this. The frequently asked question does not make any reference to voting on the Safe at Home program on the Secretary of State website, which I think is a disservice to the people who are battered women who are in this situation. But today, members, I believe this Safe at Home program addresses the question and the concerns for those women who are in a battered woman shelter. And so I would ask members to accept this amendment today. And I will continue to work on it to maybe add some language about the Safe at Home program and other information as well. So I ask for your support of the A7 amendment.
Okay, are there any questions to the amendment?
May I follow up?
Sure.
I thank you for the outlining of the Safe at Home program, which I do think is a fantastic program, and this would just address the need of people who've recently arrived at the shelter and haven't been able to do the transaction, the process of getting their P.O. box.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to mention...
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Representative Green. This is a very expedited program, but I will work with you. I am not absolutely confident with the language that is in here. I have other ideas, but to move it forward, I'd rather include the language, and then we can work together to refine the language some more, if that's okay with you.
Thank you. Representative Green has moved the A7 motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion does prevail. The amendment does pass. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, very briefly, I'd offer the move the A3 amendment. This essentially deletes Article 3 of the bill, which is related to poll books. I don't believe that we have the finances in the state right now to pay for this, and the technology certainly is in question, the brief demonstration notwithstanding. So, Madam Chair, I'd move the A3 amendment, which deletes the poll book section, and I hope brings the cost of this bill down by about $20 million, and I'd ask for roll call.
Thank you. Roll call has been requested on the A3 amendment. There will be a roll call. Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have any quick words on of advice on this
amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask members to vote no to the A3 amendment. This is not a fiscal committee, and the next committee, and I think you'll see the fiscal numbers way better than the stories that you're hearing today. So, members, I urge you to not support the A3 amendment.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin.
No.
Representative Murray.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Beard.
Nay.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Hancock.
Nay.
Representative Hornstein.
Aye.
Representative McFarland.
Nay.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Nay.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Sanders.
No.
Representative Scalzi.
Aye.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
No.
Representative Winkler.
Aye.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Are there further amendments? Hearing no further amendments.
Madam Chair, could we have a roll call on the motion, please?
Yes, a roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. I will renew my motion that House File 210 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee as amended. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin.
Aye.
Representative Murray.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hancock.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative McFarland.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sanders.
Yes.
Representative Scalzi.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Erdahl.
Yes.
Representative Winkler.
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the bill does pass as amended and is referred to State Government Finance. With that, I will adjourn the meeting until tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.